南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. How are you today? Hopefully you're healthy and safe. As promised, I'm going to start from a different book, still from the that long titled of the Nichiren Shu Worldwide Propagation Association Society, where there it is, Overseas Propagation Promotion Association. Shinjuku, Tokyo, Japan. These are writings of Nichiren in the Nichiren Shonen Zenshu, complete writings of Nichiren Shonen. Volume 3, Theology 3 by Gyoko Otani, Tokyo Shunjusha, 1994, compiled by Kyotsuhori and edited by Jay Shakashita. We are going to read, and this is going to take a little time. It's not that huge, but it is a large gosho, and rightfully so, because this is Nichiren's, and I think it's the first writing of Nichiren I've read that expresses his, albeit condensed, exploration and definition of the different periods of Shakyamuni's teachings. So we hear all the time, the Lotus Sutra is the culminating teaching. All the prior teachings were provisional, so on and so forth. And we've heard them named countless times, the Tripitaka, the assemblance period, the perfect teaching, the wisdom teaching, the so on and so forth. In this gosho, Nichiren is going to dissect that a bit. And I think for many students of Buddhism, especially those who focused either solely or largely on Nichiren's writings, this is kind of a gap that's referred to, but not much is known about. And don't misunderstand me, there's plenty of literature and sutras to be found online, in libraries, on Amazon, regarding the BDK library, very large libraries of earlier teachings of Shakyamuni's. Even the Lotus Sutra, different translations. That's how I found different translations. Albeit, you have to always be aware, especially if you're using the internet, what the source is, right? Obviously, if you go to a massive library on Shakyamuni's teachings and the library is owned by, books are stocked by, and the scholarship is written or authorized by a Tripitaka school, then you're not likely to find a whole lot of reference material on Tendai's teachings, let alone Nichiren. They might be included in there. They may not be. They may be completely not even listed, right? That's the nature of the sectarianism in Buddhism, even in the scholarship of said Buddhism. So you have to be sensitive to that, because that means that the translations you're going to read are generally going to be self-fulfilling, self-aggrandizing, right? So anyway, that whether you've delved into that on your own or that's something you've just heard, these are Nichiren's words on this subject. By no means comprehensive, but at least he addresses these. This is called an outline of all the teachings of Buddhahood. So it's not an in-depth study, but still, it's a constructive relationship of what those teachings were focused on. And obviously, since Nichiren is writing it, he's going to make it clear how he's placed them, how Tendai placed them, how in the scholarship of Buddhism over thousands of years, where, how and where and why these are placed in the order, the five periods of Shakyamuni's teachings. They're not just placed there out of punishment or a way of self-aggrandizing, right? Nichiren never does that. So let's see what Nichiren has to say, and I'll stop talking. The four doctrinal teachings of the five periods, right? The four doctrinal teachings are the Tripitaka teaching, the common teaching, the distinct teaching, and the perfect teaching. So there's all kinds of divisions in Buddhism, right? There's the five periods, there's the Hodo, the Sanran, there are sectarians, but then there are groupings of levels of teaching which identify early, more matured, more intellectual, or deeper dives, more developed, and ultimately the goal, the absolute teaching, the reason all the other ones, you've heard this before, right? So let's see how that's constructed. Why would Nichiren repeat? He didn't invent this, but why would he repeat it just as it was defined by Dengyo, by Myaolo, by Tendai, so on and so forth? The Tripitaka teachings, right? Arguably the earliest sets of teachings that spread, remember, orally throughout India and into the south of India, out into the island nations below in Asia, like Sri Lanka or Burma, or what's it called today? They keep changing the name of it. What the heck is it called? It's been in the news not that long ago. Anyway, and slowly makes itself its way around the continent to Korea and then to Japan. Also, though, the more popular, the more talked about route through the north of India, around and over the Himalayas, a very treacherous journey into China and beyond, Pakistan, so on and so forth. And then the north of China into the south of China, and by that path out to Japan, right? Mongolia, so on. So the Tripitaka teachings, very well known. They were the earliest teachings. To begin with, Nichiren describes, the Tripitaka teaching refers to that found in the Agama Sutras in Hinayana Buddhism. Already, we have a cleared up definition. We've heard him talk about the Agama Sutras like they were separate from the Hinayana Sutras, right? We've heard this many times in many Goshos we've read. But here he's defining it more clearly. The Tripitaka teachings are found in the Agama Sutras in Hinayana Buddhism. So the specific sutras, the words of Shakyamuni, are the Agama Sutras. They are the basis of sects, Hinayana, smaller vehicle, Hinayana Buddhism. And they're labeled Tripitaka, as you will find out in the next sentence. The purpose of the Agama Sutras is an explanation of the six realms of existence. Hell, hunger, animality, anger, anger, tranquility or nin or humanity and rapture. So not all 10 of the realms, but the first six. That's their purpose, exploring, as I've explained in my own way, the early teachings being just getting human beings to understand not only how their mind works, but how their mind functions with their body, their life, their actions, their behavior, their relationships. How does the mind function in regard to all of these attributes of a human being, a sentient mind? Yes? Where's the connection? How do they influence each other? That was a very, very mysterious, undiscussed relationship 3,000 years ago. Certainly to the degree Buddhism digs into it, yeah? And this was revealing the principle of causality, retribution of joys or sorrows according to deeds, yeah? What your behavior has been in the past and how that affects your present and infects or influences your future, right? Those are the early teachings within the six realms. There's an explanation of the 10 realms of existence for living beings: hell, realms of hungry spirits, beasts, asuras, demons, human beings, heavenly beings, or rapture, and Sravaka and Pratyekabuddha, learning and realization, bodhisattvas and buddhas. Concerning the environment, however, only the six realms are expounded, and therefore this teaching is called the teaching within the six realms. So they name the other four, but their focus is on how the first six function. Makes sense, because the first six are all about the way we course through samsara. And we need to understand and have a good grasp of our mind-body-environment relationships before we can start to conceive of, because learning and Pratyekabuddha aren't your learning like an encyclopedia. They're about learning how to hone that ability, that learning ability, that hearing the Shakyamuni's actual teachings about the experience of Buddhahood, how to realize from those teachings truths leading to the possibility of your own realization of enlightenment, how with that knowledge you then can pursue the life of a bodhisattva who courses in that knowledge, influencing others, and ultimately to reach a level where you're enlightened, Buddhahood. So we name them all, but first of all, you got to learn how to walk. So we're going to concentrate on things that are much more easily experienced by all human beings, like rage and competition with others. And yeah, that's our lizard self, right? Our animal self. We'll see that easily. Anger, a little bit more evolved, right? So hell, hunger. Don't tell me there's a single human in Indian history or human history who doesn't understand hunger. But maybe you only understand it from the standpoint of satiating your appetite, your need for sustenance. A little more complex, your need for interrelationships, sexual relationships, intimate relationships. That's a hunger too. Sometimes hunger is for success, for power over others, to stop being a victim. So hunger gets more complex, right? So we can spend a lot of time on the six lower realms because they're more immediate. They're more verifiable. I know what that is. I felt that last week. Easier to teach somebody who has a relationship with what you're teaching that they can use to evolve to see more clearly, right? So the Agama Sutras focus on the six realms. They list the fact that there's 10, but if there's any hope of getting to those higher realms, you got to get this under control. And this is where monasteries are created, right? Deprivation of senses in order to understand deeply those senses, so on and so forth. Concerning the environment, however, only the six realms are expounded. That's interesting that he says environment, right? Because we externalize everything. Again, because of our intimacy with these mental processes, it's easier for us to gain insights into how they function. As the Tripitaka teaching does not expound anything beyond the six realms, it does not reveal that there exists, besides such a defiled place as the land cohabited by ordinary people and sages in the triple world, the realms of desire, form, and non-form, such pure places as the land temporarily established for those who have destroyed major evil passions, deep desires, the land without hindrance for bodhisattvas of higher stages, that obstacles shed from those for people who course in that level of practice, and the land of eternal tranquil light where one can be reborn by accumulated merits, an interesting way to put it. Right? The land of tranquil light, by this very statement, is a living land of human beings, not some faraway place or some other astral plane, right? The Tripitaka teaching also says that Buddhas appear one after another throughout the worlds of the past, present, and future, but never mentions that there are Buddhas residing in the 10 directions to preach in worlds all over the universe. It's a very earthbound teaching. Understandable for the time, right? The minute you go into the universe, the mind goes magical. Woo, chariots in the sky. So let's just focus on here on earth, okay? Get this thinking, this mind thing under your belt. And then we'll explore this physical universe. Not magically, but factually, scientifically, yeah? The term Tripitaka means three baskets. The basket of sutras, the teachings of Shakyamuni. The basket of monastic rules, of course. Because if we're going to learn how the mind works and how it interrelates with everything you experience, we're just going to have to cut you off from desires that control you entirely, right? Like the kid in school is constantly looking out the window or playing games in his book or her book and just not hearing the lesson because you're off and la, 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 doing your thing, right? If you're super hungry in class, how likely are you that the teacher will look like a chocolate bar or something? You won't be able to focus on the lesson, right? It's simple, straightforward. And the third basket, the basket of commentaries. And that would generally be those who are teachers, who are exploring and trying to explain the meaning of the teachings, which is the basket of sutras, and enforcing those monastic rules, telling you why they're necessary and how they'll help you evolve your mental state. The teachings of the Buddha are thus classified and stored in three categories. The Tripitaka is further divided into three learnings. One, Buddhist precepts, another behavioral constraint, but they're Buddhist precepts. From the standpoint of your enlightenment, you should behave in this way. Two, meditation. Rules for meditation, how to meditate, what you meditate, what you're hoping to accomplish in meditation, what you're working on in the monastery in order to understand the commentaries and ultimately the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, right? And third, wisdom. How does this improve, affect, open, create insights within your mind? How to evolve this skill, this emanation of your apparatus, this mind, to see clearly, to understand clearly, to be untainted, uninfluenced. How do we improve the capacity of your mind? It is sometimes said that there are jo, kai, and e, which are those three learnings, in the order of the Buddha's preaching. There are preachings that are kai or jo or e in order of practicing, and e, kai, and jo within regard to the doctrinal teachings. So there are aspects of rules, ways of meditation, and insight to each part of the Buddhist training. In the precept basket, there are various kinds of precepts, such as the 5 precepts, the 8 precepts, the 10 good precepts, the 250 precepts, and the 500 precepts, and so on. In other words, in different levels of teaching, it's like learning, again, you learn geometry, you learn about something called theorems, not theories, theorems, right? You learn about concepts of the gradations of a circle and the nature of a triangle and the relationships of sine and cosine and tangents, right? You learn these different types of rules around concepts at different levels of geometry. Buddhism very much like that early on. In the meditation basket, there are such meditations as the ambiguous meditation, the pure meditation, the meditation without delusions, and so on. So same thing with meditation. We've got all these different ways to meditate that hopefully will open certain doors of understanding, capacity for you, your mental ability. We're raising your mind. Yes? The basket of wisdom refers to the Buddha's wisdom through which one can understand suffering. What is it? Voidness or emptiness. What is that? Impermanence, egolessness, and so on. So the teachings are very conceptual. And with these other doors we're opening in your capacity, you can apply those insights into insights of the very nature of being. Yeah? So speaking of the comparative superiority among the three learnings, those who only observe the Buddhist precepts are ordinary people who were born in the realm of human beings or heaven or rapture, looking for enlightenment or great satisfaction, right? Like an orgasm. And don't laugh, that's actually used in many Hindu religions as pointing to that sense of timelessness and bliss. The region of the desires in the triple world. Those who do not observe the precepts but practice only meditation can gain the merit of observing precepts due to the merit of the practicing of meditation. So the precepts is the lowest level of teachings. It's like if people follow rules, life will get better and they'll get more capacity. But if you study all these types of meditation, those precepts will naturally develop. Your understanding of them and your implementation of them will come from these meditations we teach. Those who practice the ambiguous meditation or the pure meditation can be born in the region of form or non-form of the triple world. In other words, your mind can grow to another level in your succeeding moments of existence, right? Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Technically, there's no past. That's dead. That's gone. And the next is built on what you're now developing this moment. So remember that thinking. Those who have learned the meditation without delusions can become Sravaka or Pratyekabuddhas. That's a more evolved understanding mentally of the precepts and the meditations. What is the goal here? Now we're starting to think about the nature of enlightenment rather than the nature of human samsaric life for betterment. We're transcending that a level. And they can be liberated from the delusions in view and thought and turn the body to ashes and annihilate consciousness. So this is an interesting translation. And I have a bit of issue with it because I think it can be very misleading. The idea of turning body ashes is simply to understand our attachment to bodiness and that our focus of mind shouldn't be on self-preservation, right? This analogy is made throughout Buddhism. At the expense of your life, don't die. That's the nature of commitment and the nature of our attachments, primarily, certainly in the six realms. If we reach the seventh and eighth realm of Sravaka and Pratyekabuddha, learning and realization, we start to discard or not pay attention to the avarice and desires and attachment bodily, not just the body, but the body entirely as an apparatus. And we begin to understand the functional relationships between all things. Annihilating consciousness, really should say annihilating ego, because without consciousness, there is no enlightenment. Enlightenment is the ninth consciousness. So to say annihilate consciousness is really to annihilate the enforced attachment thinking, which the shorthand for is ego, right? Those who have mastered the Buddha's wisdom perceive the body and mind as suffering, void, impermanent, and egoless, and are thus naturally equipped with the above two learnings. So, kind of said it there. But this is the limitation. See, Nichiren is obviating, without being prejudiced, he's obviating the nature of the teaching is thus, at this level. As a result, they become Sravaka or Pratyekabuddha. Therefore, learning to observe the precepts is inferior to learning to practice in meditation, which is in turn inferior to learning to gain wisdom. However, the main objective of the Tripitaka teaching is learning to observe the precepts. For this reason, the precepts are explained in detail in the Sutra of the Last Teaching, which summarizes the Agama Sutras. So it's not that it doesn't teach anything else, but the primary focus of the Agama Sutras is living life by the rules. And at that time in history, at this time in history, there's a lot of need for people to be primarily educated and just follow the rules. If you're going to get anywhere in life, just follow the rules. Yeah, so it's still around. But that was the primary focus then. It is true that the Tripitaka teaching tells of the six realms in the environment and the 10 realms in the region of living beings. But because the teaching emphasizes the environment, the Tripitaka Sutras are called Sutras Revealing the Six Realms. Furthermore, while these sutras may show the 10 realms in the region of living beings, the enlightenment they preach for Pratyekabuddha, or Bodhisattva or Buddhas, is nothing but that of Sravaka. Therefore, the Tripitaka teaching is also called the teaching for Sravakas. Although it is regarded as the supreme enlightenment for Buddhas, Bodhisattvas and Pratyekabuddhas that transforms the body to ashes and annihilates consciousness. In Sravaka practice, there are ranks of wise men and sages, each of which is divided into seven levels. Those still within the seven levels of wise men are unenlightened. So basically what he said is, although they include talk about enlightenment, about bodhisattva, about, as he said, annihilating consciousness, this is not a high-level teaching. This is teaching those who are learning about the intent of Buddha's teachings, Sravakas. They're not even truly Pratyekabuddhas, people of realization, even though they talk about it as a potential in the realm of living beings, of personal practice. They're really only talking about students, learners, right? Hearing the Buddha's teachings. The seven wise men, those who have knowledge, who have finally gotten to that point where they're qualified to listen to and understand to a degree the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, they have three wisdom and four virtuous roots. A lot of dissections, a lot of rules, a lot of precepts, yeah? Five ways to eliminate delusions, obviously reflected in the precepts and the meditations, yeah? To observe the four non-Buddhist misconceptions separately, to observe the four non-Buddhist misconceptions altogether. The four virtuous roots, to burn up evil passions, in other words, to somehow eliminate their earthly desires, to see clearly the law of cause and effect. Oh, that doesn't just happen randomly. Actions lead to other reactions, so on and so forth. To understand that, that's very primary teaching. To realize the doctrine of the Four Noble Truths, right? And to be the wisest. In other words, you're the one with the most gold stars in class. You excel at being able to understand the order of the precepts, how to do the different meditations, so on and so forth. Those who stay in the seven levels of wise men are wiser than ordinary men of the six realms. Of course, they're studying, right? Though they potentially have delusions and evil passions within themselves, they are wise men because they reject the delusions of life and death and suppress their evil passions. So they're getting it under control. They're disciplined. They're like the wise men Xu Yu and Chao Fu in ancient China mentioned in a non-Buddhist Chinese scripture. We're not familiar with those stories, but he's going to give us a clue here. It is said that King Yao tried to appoint Xu Yu to be the chief of the nine states, but thinking that his ears were defiled by hearing such a plan, because that's ambition. Ambition was seen as something very hungry ghosts, right? Animality, anger. It's the lower six worlds. Can't do that. Can't have ambition. So because he was offered that, his ears, he thought, were being defiled by this request of him. So he washed them in a river. So powerful is this story about not being someone with ambition that when he washed his ears in the river, Chao Fu, who happened to hear the story, just as he brought his cows to drink from the river, he stopped his cows from drinking in the river. Like somehow his cows would get this defiled idea of ambition in them. And how terrible would that be? That's fascinating. So from this, Nichiren goes to the five ways to eliminate delusions. We're learning a lot about Tripitaka, aren't we? And the Agama Sutras. Interesting. One, to calm and a distracted mind by counting the number of breaths. Oh my gosh, how many times have I heard about breathing meditation? And isn't that how to attain enlightenment? And that's all one needs do. Come on, people. It's a tool to self-calm, but it's not a tool to self-Buddhize, right? To self-realize the Buddha wisdom of the entire engine of life, the universe, and our role in it, our observation of it. No, this is quite clearly to calm a distracted mind by counting the number of breaths. Okay. When a doctor or an emergency person or a friend, like these are rules of first aid, and somebody just had an accident or some shock or whatever, the first thing you do is calm them down. Take some deep breaths. Sit down, relax. Right? Same thing. Number two, to eliminate greed by observing impurities in the body. Not sure how that works. You could dive into that more deeply and see where that comes from. But I think even thinking about it in terms of our imperfections, we can make a correlation between our desire for other things, like we're filling up some little holes in ourselves, right? I've heard people say that. In French, there's a saying about eating food, that sometimes you just eat to fill a hole. And then you're satiated. Oh, I ate enough. J'ai bouché un trou. I plugged a hole. And the analogy, it's kind of nonsensical, but in a way it makes sense. Yeah. To eliminate jealousy by having compassion in mind. Well, that person always, you know, they take this or blah, blah, blah. And instead think of them and think of them as, wow, that person's so needy. Or they cause so much harm to themselves by just the way they treat the people around them or the land around them. They cause their own misery. How sad. How could I help that person realize they're causing their own strife, right? To eliminate ignorance by seeing the interrelationship of all existence. That's a biggie. And what you're eliminating is ignorance. Because the more you understand how things interrelate, the more wise you are, the more understanding you are of the processes of everything, life. To overcome obstacles against the Buddhist practice by seeing the six elements constituting the world. This is also called Nembutsu. Remember that term? Take that apart for a minute, that term. Nembutsu. Butsu, we always see in words indicating Buddhahood. So what does Nem mean? Nembutsu. To be absorbed in seeing the Buddha. Single-mindedly seeing the Buddha. Now, Nichiren very much rails against Nembutsu, because the butsu that's being focused on is a non-existent storytelling expedient means. Worse, it's an expedient means that teaches people that this life is not for enlightenment, that it's only after they leave this life that they'll get to the pure land of Amida Buddha. And so they chant Amida Buddha, Amida Buddha. Ah, that's not Buddhism. So when Nichiren talks about Nembutsu, he's talking about those people of the Pure Land sects, of the Amida Butsu sects, who are focusing on emulating death. They don't get it. That's not Buddhism. Buddhism is about this life, this here and now. Where are you going? That pure land isn't anywhere else. It's right here. You simply need to awaken. So don't go dreamland into Amida Buddha land that doesn't exist. That's not even Buddhism. So Nichiren uses Nembutsu in a very negative way constantly, but now we see the root of it is simply this absorption into seeing Buddha. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but if it's misdirected, it's a horrible thing, right? Interesting. Finding out a lot, aren't we? Let's go a little further. He continues. The first of the three wisdoms focuses on the five ways to eliminate delusions. Three of these, five of that, contains seven of that. A lot of numbers in early Buddhism, yeah? One, to calm and distract the mind by counting the numbers of breath. Two, to eliminate greed by observing impurities in the body. Yep. To eliminate jealousy by having compassion in mind. To eliminate anger or ignorance by seeing the interrelationship of all existence. And five, to overcome obstacles against the Buddhist practice by seeing the six elements, earth, water, fire, wind, space, and consciousness, that constitute all existence in the world. This is also called Nembutsu. To observe the four non-Buddhist misconceptions separately. Remember, he mentioned that earlier. One, body, pure for Brahmins, impure for the Buddha. Interesting. These are the four non-Buddhist misconceptions. Feeling, the triple world is comfortable for Brahmins, but suffering for the Buddha. So this is obviously a tit for tat of the prevailing philosophies of India at the time, all Brahmanic. All variations, Hinduism, all based on the Brahman gods. And the Brahman perspective of perfection that isn't available to us, but dictates us, comes from without us, versus Buddha, who says, okay, let's start from the basics. You all believe that life is stressful or shorthand suffering. So they assign that to Buddha. The misconceptions from a non-Buddhist is that the Buddha Brahmins are comfortable all over the universe, sky, land, right? All those deities and gods in Brahmanic religion are like container gods. They don't experience. They create experience. Whereas Buddha's all about suffering, right? You ever heard that? Well, I'm a Buddhist. Oh, you're all about all life is suffering. How depressing. No. You don't understand at all, right? The third one, mind. Permanent for Brahmins. The mind exists throughout all time space. Impermanent for the Buddha. Right? We talk about that a lot. And all phenomena, finally, number four. The existence of a self for Brahmins constantly abides in the universe. And for Buddha, there's no self. That's a primary illusion. So think about how Buddha was received in that environment in India. Yeah. Secondly, there are four ways of observing the four non-Buddhist misconceptions separately and refuting them. The first misconception focuses on the condition of the body, namely that Brahmins regard the flesh as clean while the Buddha sees it as impure. Impure, again, that's an English translation. Really, the Buddha doesn't see the flesh as impure so much as he sees it as a distraction from enlightenment. And that way, impure, do you see? The second concerns the condition of feeling, where Brahmins regard the triple world as comfortable, while the Buddha sees it as anxiety and stress, and right? The third centers on the condition of the mind, that Brahmins regard the mind as permanent, While the Buddha sees it as impermanent, right? No bag of Bob, no box of Betty. It goes on from lifetime to lifetime. Yeah. That would require an existing mind, or as the Christians like to call it, a soul, or I think the Jews and the Muslims do too. Whatever. Brahmins insisted on the eternity of mind, the comfort of the triple world, the existence of a self in all living beings, and the purity of body. On the other hand, the Buddha, denying all these, expounded that the triple world is a state of stress and anxiety. The body is an impure dedication that's not where enlightenment is. The mind is impermanent. It's only here while you're sentient as this apparatus. It's an emergent property. And all beings have no self. In other words, we are a process of life. We are not a thing in itself. That's why there's no permanence to anything, including a mind. Thirdly, to observe all the four misconceptions together means to observe the four conceptions in each of the four conditions, to observe the four conditions within each of the four conceptions, and finally, to observe the four conditions with the four conceptions as a whole. In short, the suffering, impurity, impermanence, and egolessness, which were also shown in observing the four misconceptions separately, are practiced and observed altogether here. Next, the first way in the four virtuous routes, namely to burn up evil passions, means to try to evaporate evil passions by wisdom, as when firewood lit by a fire generates heat and smoke. A fire is likened to wisdom, and firewood means evil passions. So you bring to light the delusions of passions that are not life-affirming, that take you away from your enlightenment, yeah? I don't want to go on too long here. Let's see if I can get through this part, and we'll take a break. The second way to see clearly the law of cause and effect is thus named because one can perceive in detail the law of cause and effect in the world and in Buddhism as if one is seeing through everything clearly from the vantage of mountaintops high above the clouds. And this is when I make that analogy. We become observers of the process instead of wrapped around in the waves and the rapids and hitting rocks. We stand beside the rapids and appreciate the same power without being completely immobilized by it. The ranks between the five ways to eliminate delusions, which is the first of the three wisdoms, to the way of seeing clearly the law of cause and effect and retrogressive. If one commits evil deeds due to bad karma, one cannot avoid falling into the evil realms. However, those who can see clearly the law of cause and effect will not lose their virtuous roots, even if they fall back into the evil realms, because they'll understand what happened. They won't just follow along and doomed to repeat. They will learn and they will see and they observe. The third way, i.e., to realize the doctrine of the Four Noble Truths, is the rank in which one can never fall back to the evil realms because it means one is higher than the top of the mountain. So finally, learn to avoid falling into those traps that suck you in. You know, this is, I don't know if I should bring it up again. It's getting rid of bad habits. Let's just put it that way. Being wise enough, observant enough, that you don't allow yourself to fall into bad habits before you go, oh, damn, I did a bad thing again, right? A little bit more wisdom. The fourth way, i.e., to be the wisest in the world, is the most excellent of all the unenlightened ranks. Those in this rank are categorized within the rank of wise men. They are also close to the level of sages, that they will become sages with slightly further improvement. So they're really good students. They got a degree, right? And now we're going to explore the seven sages, those who go right way to nirvana. And I think that's a good place to stop. And we'll continue there in the next video. I hope you're finding this helpful. There's very little discussion amongst those who practice Nichiren on Nichiren's description of the scholarship he obviously studied, but encapsulating them in simple, quick reference chart kind of form to remind people of these stages of learning. He's doing it in service of demonstrating once again how the Lotus Sutra is the ultimate form. But to say that is one thing and expect everyone to just go, okay. And to describe early, middle, more progress, you know, to describe them accurately and give you an idea of why the Lotus Sutra, why does he say that? Why does Tendai say that? Why does Dengyo say that? Why does Buddhist scholarship constantly go here? It's obvious, it's in the teachings themselves. So it's another way Nichiren is providing insight that should be in anyone who's practicing Buddhism to see, but people are lazy. And people are told what to do. And so they do what they're told what to do. So if some wise man with a lot of knowledge comes to them, to you, to me, to others, humans, and starts telling us this is the way, and you don't study to verify it, then you're just going to do what they say until you find them. That something doesn't work or something doesn't fit. Human beings, right? So Nichiren is taking the time and he's saying, look, I keep repeating this and showing you the scholarship and why the Lotus Sutra is the ultimate, the self-practice, the goal of Shakyamuni from the get-go. But let me show you in Shakyamuni's own words why the progression is obvious. How do we get here from there? So you can make up your own mind. So you can gain the insights that will let you see the same thing I see. Right? And just like Shakyamuni, I think to myself every day, how can I bring people to enlightenment? Right? That's what we read in Gongyo every day. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your support. Go to Patreon or paypal.me/SifuSylvain if you can afford it. Any little thing helps. But primarily, liking, subscribing are big mechanisms in YouTube to help promote and therefore get these videos and these teachings into more eyeballs and more eardrums so that we can spread this Lotus Sutra Buddhism and change the directions in this world. We have so much negativity and crisis around egos and stupidity. We don't need to be doing that, right? So let's change it together. Let's make a huge influence. Get this world back on track. I'd like it to stick around for a while. We got work to do, right? All right, my friends. Thank you once again. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Keep your practice strong. Be kind to yourself. Watch your health. Still have a lot of danger out there health-wise. All right? Take precautions. And I will see you in the next one, okay? Thanks for being here. And bye for now.